This is Rush to Reason.
You are going to shut your damn yapper and listen for a change, because I got you pegged, sweetheart. You want to take the easy way out because you're scared. And you're scared because if you try and fail, there's only you to blame. Let me break this down for you. Life is scary. Get used to it. There are no magical fixes.
With your host, John Rush.
My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir.
You haven't made everybody equal. You've made them the same, and there's a big difference.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
Are you crazy? Am I? Or am I so sane that you just blew your mind?
It's Rush to Reason, brought to you by Absolute Electrical Heating and Air, with your host, John Rush.
And I'm your host, John Rush, Rush to Reason, KLZ 560. Thanks so much for listening today. We appreciate it very much. It is Thursday, and because it's Thursday, Dr. Kelly Victory joins us, and I appreciate her taking time out of her day to do so, because we talk, I don't know, everything you can think of, Dr. Victory, when it comes to COVID vaccines, you name it, we talk about it. Welcome. How are you this week?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, as always, John.
Nothing against talking to you, and I love it, but, you know, at some point in time, can we stop this?
It does feel like Groundhog Day, doesn't it? I really thought, if you had asked me 21 months ago if we'd still be doing this coming into the fall and holiday season of 2021, I would have said no way, yeah, no how.
Me too.
So it is really, really bizarre.
It is.
And tragic, frankly.
It is tragic. You're right. No, thank you. Yes, I'm glad you said that. And again, not that I don't like talking to you, because I do, but you would think at this point in time, as much as we've done this, things would start to change. And yet today even, we've got the president out, you know, quote-unquote campaigning, if you would, to make sure that the, virus gets stuck into more arms, I guess you could say.
Yeah, they continue to double down on their vaccine efforts for certain, and they continue at the same time, more troubling to me, John, they continue at the same time to ignore and avoid conversation about the one thing that we know actually works for COVID, mm-hmm. Which is early treatment. I have no problem with them continuing to work on developing a safe and effective vaccine for this virus or any other of the bazillion viruses that we haven't cracked the vaccine code for yet. But I find it very troubling that they continue to ignore and actually try to deep six any conversation about effective, safe, readily available early treatment options.
And for those of you listening, I can tell you firsthand everything that Dr. Victory just said is exactly spot on. I've got a client of mine down in Arizona that I coach and have been for a number of years, and they have a particular friend up in the upper Northwest. I'm not going to get into specifics, but upper Northwest, and there was a friend of theirs that a family member, you know, husband of somebody they knew, caught COVID under the age of 45, by the way, did have some other health issues, which, you know, a lot of folks do. I get that. Ended up in the hospital, ended up on a vent. They got to the point where the vent wasn't doing any good any longer, so they took him off the vent. And I guess in this particular case, Dr. Kelly, there were some pre-treatment sort of things they could have done. Of course, they chose not to do any of the things that we talk about on a regular basis. They then had an opportunity to put him on and I don't know exactly the terminology, but there's a type of ventilator you can put somebody on to help them with the recovery of their lungs. And the hospital's answer back to them was, well, because he's under the age of 45, we only do that for over 45, so no, you're just going to pull the plug.
Yeah, we are witnessing right now a level of therapeutic nihilism that I have never seen in my entire career in medicine, John. We have an entire cocktail of readily available, safe, effective medications for COVID. Yet what people are getting when they go to the hospital is either they go in, they get tested for COVID, they're positive, and they're sent home and told to do nothing mm-hmm. unless they get really sick. Which is tantamount to saying, you know, you go out and you see smoke coming from your toaster and you figure, well, I'll just go to bed. And if I wake up and the house is on fire in the morning, I guess I'll call. It makes no sense why you would do that, why you would wait. And I have made the statement and I stand by it. If in 2021, knowing what we know about treatment options, if someone gets COVID and gets admitted to the hospital with it and isn't treated with azithromycin, zinc, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, inhaled steroids, blood thinners, vitamin D, if they don't get those things and they end up dying, I'm here to tell you, they didn't die from COVID. They died from malpractice.
Mm. Good one.
And that is the hard, cold fact.
Yep.
We know how to treat this. And if anyone wants to know more details about it, the website, earlycovidcare.org, is replete with resources not only for practitioners who might want to know the actual treatment protocols if they haven't been keeping up on it, and there are resources there for patients, not only about treatment, but where to find a doctor in your area who might be like-minded, a whole compendium of articles and studies and interviews with physicians who can talk people through this. There really is no excuse at this point, and hasn't been, frankly, for well over a year, for people to be dying untreated. Hmm. This isn't any longer a pandemic of the unvaccinated. It's a pandemic of the untreated, and it's unconscionable and truly needs to stop.
We've got a call coming in, and we can take this one before the break. Bill in Aurora, you're on with Dr. Kelly Victory.
Hey, John, it's Bill in Boulder. Dr. Kelly, thanks so much for coming on every week. This is very important, great information that you get out to us. I have two quick questions for you, ma'am. The first one is, I came across this on CDC's website the other day. It was a table 2E, which actually discussed approved treatments. And, of course, the first one was remdesivir, which we won't go there right now. But I was surprised to see that the second listed treatment was actually ivermectin. Have you seen that or familiar with that?
Well, I haven't seen that particular chart that you're showing me. There's absolutely no question, two things, that ivermectin is incredibly, incredibly effective for the treatment of COVID-19, and we've known this for well over a year. There are now is a meta-analysis of 64 different studies, 64, 58 of which show overwhelming decreases, statistically significant decreases in hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths from the giving ivermectin. Furthermore, as you said, remdesivir, the wonder drug to date for COVID-19, is essentially useless. It has shown absolutely no impact on no impact on mortality, and as you said, alluding to, it causes profound kidney damage and has been associated with nothing other than prolonged hospital stays. I guess the good news is it costs $3,100 of treatment, so somebody's making a lot of money on it. In contradistinction, ivermectin, costs about 12 cents a pill, and people turn around in a matter of days with it. So I would like to believe that they will start allowing us to use it. It's ridiculous, absolutely unconscionable that we haven't been allowed to use it. If you look at parts of the world that are using it, and we're using it before COVID because of places like India that have a lot of issues with intestinal parasites, those places had low rates of COVID in the first place. In the most populated province in India, Uttar Pradesh, with 241 million people, essentially has eradicated cases of COVID simply by giving the entire population ivermectin. Very important drug.
Right, prophylactically, absolutely. So the other thing that I wanted, well, there's a million things I want to talk about, especially with like the revelation from Merck yesterday, which is ridiculous. And I texted John an article about that this morning. But the other question I had for you is kind of more general, and I'll just kind of leave it to you to kind of assume where I'm going with this. But can you paint a picture for us, the connection between cancer and the formation of cancer cells, I should say, mRNA and mitochondria?
Well, it's a complex thing to do on the radio with lay folks, but I will tell you the top level or high level comments that I would make are that, number one, scientists have been working on making a safe and effective mRNA vaccine for well over a decade. This isn't new technology. It's simply that it's never been done successfully. In past trials, those mRNA vaccines have failed miserably, sometimes with disastrous results during the animal trials. One of the problems is we have no idea how long that mRNA will exhibit itself or will be acted upon. And therefore, in the case of these COVID-19 vaccines, we have no idea for how long you will continue to produce that spike protein. And the spike protein itself, if people don't know, for COVID-19, is highly toxic. It's pathogenic by itself, causes blood clots and a lot of other problems, including potentially cancers. Furthermore, although we were told that these vaccines, you get shot in the arm and the deltoid muscle, and we were told that that's where the vaccine stays. Well, it turns out that's not true at all, and that Pfizer and Moderna knew that before the vaccines were rolled out. A leaked study from Japan showed that that vaccine not only doesn't stay in the arm, it travels far and wide to essentially every organ system, including the heart, the lungs, the kidney, the spleen, the liver, and most concerning, or perhaps as concerning, it concentrates in the reproductive organs, specifically the ovaries and also, the testicles.
I had also seen, too, that it was bioaccumulating I also saw that it was bioaccumulating in bone marrow, which is very concerning given the production of T cells and B cells.
So suffice to say, these vaccines, and I am not anti-vaccine. I am extraordinarily pro-vaccine.
But I am
respectful, however, of the incredible complexity of creating vaccines and the incredible complexity of the immune system. It's not always predictable. It's not always reliable how different people will respond. And that is why the average vaccine takes 4 to 6 years to come to market, if it ever makes it at all. The idea of having rolled out these vaccines in well under a year and giving them to people, groups of people on whom they've simply never been tested, groups like pregnant women, lactating women, children, people with underlying autoimmune diseases, people on chemotherapy, people on immunosuppressive drugs, or God forbid, all the people who already had and recovered from COVID. We don't know what the results are going to be in those people. And I'm not talking about 90 and 120-day results. I want the 12-month, 24-month, 36-month data, the way that we required it for things like measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, you know, those sorts of vaccines. So I think that we need to apply really some significant thought to moving forward with this mass vaccine initiative, particularly given the low risk of the virus for so many groups, including children.
Absolutely. And I think, too, real quick, I'll end with this. The reason I was kind of asking about the connection to cancer was I was aware of some of the observations that Dr. Ryan Cole up in Idaho has been making recently and seeing some increases in cancer rates.
That's right.
So, I'll leave it at that, and I appreciate everything you do.
Thanks,
again,
Bill.
Dr. Kelly. And,
no, thank you.
You guys take care.
Thank you very much, Bill. And I talked about that doctor and the findings here a few weeks ago, Dr. Kelly, and that this particular doctor, I'm sure you've heard, is finding a huge increase in cancer patients that he's now treating because of, and he's finding this in vaccinated patients, not unvaccinated patients.
There's no question, John. And Ryan Cole is been working on this alongside, we've been working on the same groups from the beginning of this, and he is a remarkable individual and a pathologist in Idaho. And he's correct. We are seeing remarkable upticks in certain types of cancers. Likewise, we are seeing, if you look, we're seeing evidence of microclots in an enormous percentage, well over 50% of people getting vaccinated. If you actually test via a blood test called a D-dimer, which is a very, very sensitive test that picks up the formation of microscopic blood clots, that is, you know, people are developing these microscopic blood clots. And now, although Pfizer doesn't want the public to know it, they are looking very, very carefully at their own vaccine to see if, in fact, the Pfizer vaccine is responsible for causing heart attacks as a result of this formation of microclots. So in addition to myocarditis, the inflammation of the heart muscle itself, there's a question about whether it's actually causing heart attacks. These are things that normally should have been sorted out during the prolonged and vigorous testing period prior to rolling it out.
That's right.
It would be one thing if we had no access to other treatments for a particular disease, or it would be one thing if this was smallpox with a mortality rate of 38% or 40%. But it's not. It's COVID. It's a virus that for the vast majority of people poses far less risk than influenza. And for healthy people under the age of 50, we know what the risk factors are. And most people don't have those risk factors. So the idea that we prematurely rolled these out, I think, was a colossal error.
Agreed.
And I believe this will go down in history as a public health failure of epic proportion.
All right, more to come. Don't go anywhere, folks. If you got a question, by the way, for Dr. Kelly, send me a text message. I can get it done quicker that way, actually, if you want to do that. 307-200-8222. Just send me a quick synopsis of what you want me to ask, and I'll do that. 307-200-8222. We'll be right back, though.
No liberal media bias here. This is Rush to Reason.
All right, Rush to Reason, Denver's Afternoon Rush, KLZ 560. Dr. Kelly, I'm also curious when it comes to, you know, there's a lot of unknowns, let's face it. And I realize in the medical world, there's a lot of unknowns when it comes to diagnosing individuals and trying to find out, you know, what was the real cause of what happened, especially when it comes to older adults, I should say. So, I've got folks that I know, and I don't want to give any names out because I don't want to do that. I'm not going to give names or do anything along those lines and even tell folks how I know about some of these things, but I know of an older individual that got the vaccine probably within the last 6 months and just suffered a stroke. Question I have is, and I know it's an older adult where things like that could happen regardless, but it's just to me very coincidental when somebody that in this case is very, very, very healthy, I know this individual personally, very, very healthy prior, has a vaccine and within 6 months has a stroke.
Well, I think in that we are seeing that hand over fist, unfortunately, John. The VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, is antiquated beyond belief and only captures a small fraction of the actual adverse events that are happening. One of the problems is that physicians in general have been hesitant, I believe, to actually connect the dots. They say, okay, well, this person, say, 70 years old, so he had a stroke. And you are right. The people who actually know that individual are saying, wait a minute, this guy was healthy as an ox, you know, ran, rode his bike, was a hiker, ate a healthy diet, and all of a sudden he has this stroke. Now, where you can't necessarily say it is a direct result of the vaccine, it deserves to be looked at.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the problem. We need to be looking at these events. And that is the job of the CDC and the FDA. We have hundreds of thousands, that is not hyperbole, hundreds of thousands of reports of adverse events in this country alone, upwards of, you know, 20-some thousand deaths that have been reported to the VAERS site, which is, as I said, likely a fraction.
Right, right.
And yet the CDC and the FDA together, they have 41,000 employees. And haven't had time to look into these yet. They've done nary an autopsy. They haven't looked at one of these reports yet. Okay? I find that unconscionable. We need to look at these. And I will say, for all of its flaws, the VAERS system, if we actually compare, you know, apples to apples, the number of deaths, just to put this in perspective, the number of deaths that have been reported to the VAERS system since the January of this year regarding the COVID-19 vaccines is more than double the number of deaths reported to the VAERS system from all other 30 other vaccines over a 22-year period combined.
Wow.
So think about that, okay? Put that in perspective. So people will say, yes, you know, Dr. Victory, but just because something's reported to VAERS doesn't mean it was directly related to the vaccine. And I'll say that's true, but it's apples to apples. That was the same with those other 30 vaccines over the last 22 years as well.
Wow.
Yet somehow we've had more than twice the number of deaths in a nine-month period as we had over 22 years on 30 vaccines. I mean, if that doesn't make you know, the hair on the back of your neck stand up, I don't know what will.
I agree.
We need to slow the roll on this.
All right. Another question came in, and several. I've got one of my own as well. Does the vaccine's spike protein adhere to the ACE2 cell and inhibit its function?
Yes. Okay. These are way too complicated, really, to be.
I have no idea what just got said, by the way.
Fundamentally, as I said, the spike protein, I think, for the average lay person, and not that I'm trying to avoid answering the questions, what I don't want to do is get into the weeds
and lose half the audience.
What I will say, however, once again, is that the spike protein itself on the outside of COVID-19 is pathogenic. It wreaks a lot of havoc, including things like blood clotting and lung damage and inflammation. It can set off that cytokine storm, that inflammatory cascade that ends up causing people to fill up their lungs with fluid and things of that sort. So it is really problematic, I think, in addition to the fact that these mRNA vaccines are unpredictable, despite giving you a vaccine that makes you start producing the spike protein, makes you start producing the thing that is actually toxic itself, I think is highly problematic. And suffice to say, I think we will continue to see many of these bizarre sorts of symptoms that patients are having. Many are having neurologic symptoms following the vaccines, tingling, numbness, pain, profound fatigue, headaches, muscle aches, joint swelling, lots of things that sound an awful lot like autoimmune responses to me. Hmm. And again, it will take time for us to sort this out. And it's the reason why these things generally take years and years, not days or months to roll out.
Another question came in, and I'm sure I'm saying this one wrong. Zinc and quercetin at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Can you take them at the same time?
They should be taken at the same time.
Okay.
Quercetin is a naturally occurring compound. It occurs in many, many fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
The problem is you can't actually eat enough of it through your diet, so I generally recommend supplementing it. The function of quercetin is that it's what we call a zinc ionophore. It actually helps zinc get into the cells. Zinc has a hard time getting out of the bloodstream and actually into the cell, which is where it needs to be in order to kill a virus. Zinc is a very powerful antiviral agent, but it has to get to where the virus is, which is intracellular. Quercetin opens the door, if you will, to the cell and lets the zinc go rushing in. That is one of the functions, incidentally, of hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine is also an excellent zinc ionophore, but taking quercetin does a great job. If you take it along with the zinc, you will help the zinc that you're taking get into the cells where it can kill not only COVID, but a host of viruses. Mm. The common cold, influenza, lots of viruses that are out there can be inhibited by taking supplemental zinc.
All right. This is a text message a little bit longer, but I want to read this because I can't say it without just reading it. This person cleans for husband and wife that are both doctors. They've taken all the shots and boosters, and which there aren't any yet, but they will be. They'll be taking the booster coming forward. They do not accept any of the statistics or data about why I'm not getting the vaccine. What's the best argument that would convince them? They are horrified that this person's not getting the shot and are ready to vaccinate their 2- and 4-year-old children when they become available.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand the question. They're asking what's the best argument.
What's the best argument against these two doctors about not getting vaccinated?
Yeah, well,
because basically these doctors have bought everything hook, line, and sinker without doing any research on their own. They won't accept any data is what this person's saying.
Yes, what I would say is that every medical treatment or intervention should be undertaken after conducting a thoughtful and well-informed risk-benefit analysis. That means I don't care if it's an antibiotic, a surgical procedure you're thinking about having done, chemotherapy, whatever it is, certainly a vaccine, you need to know your individual risk from that particular disease, in this case COVID, and weigh that against the potential risks from the treatment, in this case the vaccine. Healthy people under the age of 50, and this is, you know, the CDC's numbers, not Dr. Kelly Victory's numbers, should they contract COVID, have a 99.98% chance of making a full recovery. 99.98. So you need to weigh that against the potential risks of the vaccine. And I would submit that we simply don't know the risks from the vaccine enough to make that calculation, to really be able to make a thoughtful mm-hmm. and informed risk-benefit calculation. If my parents were living today, say in their mid-90s, in a nursing home or an assisted living facility, I may very well suggest that they would get vaccinated, because the risk to people in that age category living in a nursing facility, the risk of COVID, of death from COVID, is probably around 4 or 5%. And I would say that that is, you know, may well be higher than the risk from the vaccine, particularly because my 95-year-old parents wouldn't be worried about developing cancer 10 years later, or fertility issues, or autoimmune issues that might develop 3 or 5 years later, because they're already in their mid-90s. That's a different calculation mm-hmm. than a healthy 35-year-old.
Right.
So everyone's calculation is different. Mine is different from yours, John.
Right.
So I think that one of the problems I'm seeing is this mass psychosis amongst clinicians, my own colleagues, who are foisting a one size fits all treatment when people's risk is entirely different based on their own individual health history, their age, and many, many other demographic features. So I don't see how we can suggest this to everybody. It isn't a one-size-fits-all, and that defies, in my mind, the most sacrosanct of all dictums in medicine, which is first do no harm. You are going to hurt a heck of a lot of people by vaccinating them with an untested vaccine when their risk from the actual virus was de minimis.
Good point. All right. My own personal question here, and I know we've talked about this, but I want to make sure we get this back out there for folks that are listening. I believe I know the answer from talking to you as many times as we have. Let's say somebody got the vaccine, say, 10 months ago. Do they still have a risk of some of these, you know, adverse effects, clotting, things like that? And do we know how long some of those adverse effects could last?
That is the million-dollar question. The answer is, unfortunately, I don't know, because these vaccines, you're hitting the nail on the head with that question. These vaccines didn't exist 12 months ago, okay, 13 mm-hmm. months ago.
Right.
They were started
right.
in development the late summer last year. So we don't have any more data. The longest possible data we could have is whatever 12 or 14 months worth of data, and that was just on the relatively small group of test subjects. These vaccines didn't begin to be given to the public until into January of this year. So you're talking about now we're at the 9-month mark. They didn't even start to be tested on children until late April, early May. So you've got maybe 6 months, 5 months worth of data on children total. They've never been tested in pregnant women in any significant numbers.
Mm-hmm.
They've never been tested in a randomized trial in people who already had COVID. And it appears from the preliminary data that people who already had COVID, who don't need this vaccine because their natural immunity is very strong, but those people actually look to have a higher risk of an adverse event from these vaccines. So I wish I could answer this question and say, well, no, if you've gotten to the 10-month mark or the 11-month mark, or if you hit that magical 12-month mark, all of a sudden your risks of bad side effects from this vaccine go away. I simply don't know.
Right.
I can't say that they don't, but I can't.
You don't know
that
they do either.
Because
right.
we don't have the data.
Right.
And unfortunately, when I say to people, you know, how the heck did they, you know, get this, over the finish line so quickly on, you know, Operation Warp Speed, and people will say, well, it's because they put, you know, threw a bunch of money at it. Unfortunately, you could throw all the money in the world at something in medicine. There is no substitute for time. I don't care how many bazillions of dollars and man hours you want to put to it. Time is time. There is no substitute for it. There's only one way to get 24, 36, 48-month safety data, and that's to let 24, 36, and 48 months go by.
Mm.
I don't care how
right.
much money you want to throw it. It's a hard fact.
Right.
Not everything can be rushed just because you want to rush it and you throw a lot of money at it.
Well said. All right, I want to take a quick break. Before I do that, though, I want to leave a question with you that we can answer when we come back. And I know this is going to sound a little bit conspiratorial, if you would, on my part, but I firmly believe that what's going on with the vaccine push is because of everything you and I continue to talk about, that there is a culling of sorts, if you would, even a shift in the workforce, if you would, in lots of key areas of our workforce across the country, everything from nurses, doctors, policemen, firemen, folks in the military, and so on. So I believe there's a culling that's going on. And the question I have for you, and I don't want to sound like I'm a tinfoil hat wearing guy by any stretch of the imagination, but if the powers that be really know everything that you and I are talking about, which I believe they do, has everyone that claimed to have gotten a vaccine really gotten one, or did some get a placebo knowing that they needed to make sure those folks stayed around no matter what, and they did not really get a real vaccine? We'll talk about that in a moment when we come back. Dr. Kelly Victory with us. If you got a question, 307-200-8220. All right, we're back. Dr. Kelly Victory with me as we do this on every Thursday for at least an hour. Sometimes we do more than that. We'll plan a little bit longer session here in the near future as well. So, Dr. Kelly, I left you with, again, my sort of conspiracy, if you would, and I don't want to call it that because I really do think that there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. I think we're being, duped in a very big way in this country. I think you and I continue to prove that week after week. And, you know, maybe my question is a little bit outlandish, but if there is a culling going on, which I believe there is, did in fact everybody that's in a high position and high power in this country get a real vaccine like they claim, or did they get something else, or did they not get anything?
Great question, and I'll tell you a few comments here, John. First of all, the egregious censorship that's going on, the need to silence people and silence any dissenters is the first part, whether they're silencing me by kicking me off YouTube and Twitter, or they're silencing parents by identifying any parent who complains about a mask mandate or critical race theory at a school board meeting is now called a domestic terrorist, or getting rid of any employee, healthcare employee, law enforcement, military, who refuses to take a vaccine. Any way you cut it, you are culling the herd. You are culling out the population and silencing one entire sector, anybody who says, I don't agree with you, I don't agree with your narrative, and I'd like to assert my own individual civil liberties. That is no longer being tolerated. Whether or not many of these people at the highest levels actually got the vaccine, I have wondered myself. Our very own Saint Fauci, I have significant questions about whether or not Anthony Fauci got the vaccine. And here's why. Not only because I think he's got to be knowledgeable about the fact that this vaccine has significant problems associated with it. These vaccines, it's not just the one, all of them have significant problems. And because he sat down and on national television, got the, you know, rolled up his sleeve, got the, quote, shot in his arm, and then 24 hours later, when asked whether he had any ill effect, he patted his other arm and said, yes, it's just a little sore. He had gotten the shot on TV, supposedly in his left deltoid, and on Monday morning, he's patting his right arm and saying, yes, it's a little sore. I wonder what he actually got and if he got a shot at all. And frankly, I have no proof of that. That's purely conjecture.
I know. For everybody listening, I don't either. I just, you know, again, and Dr. Kelly, this is what happens when the government isn't honest with you. When they censor certain information, which in this case they've censored anything that's anti what they want the message to be, you know, anytime those things happen, you know, you do start wondering what's really going on here. And in a way, they're creating some of this skepticism on their own. If they don't want that skepticism, then you know what? They need to let things go the way they're supposed to and let people ask the right questions and do the things that we would normally do as Americans. But the way they're doing it, they're causing some of these thoughts I and you have.
Absolutely, and the mainstream media is completely complicit with it. Let's take, you know, one of the things that was supposedly total conspiracy, tinfoil hat wearing stuff, Alex Jones level conspiracy, is when I came out in February last year, February of 2020, and said on national radio that there was no question in my mind that this virus was not naturally occurring, that it would had been manipulated in a lab.
Right.
And I said anyone with a lick of sense or any background in virology knew that once you looked at the genomic sequencing of it. And I was absolutely lambasted, derided, kicked off social media, called a quack and a hack and everything in between. Well, lo and behold,
you were right.
Turns out,
yeah.
No kidding, finally, the cat's out of the bag. I talked about the gain of function research last year when everyone said, no way, no how. It's absolutely true. And, you know, if you take fast forward to the mainstream media going over, you know, out of their way to ridicule anybody who even talked about ivermectin, let alone prescribed it, you know, the horse dewormer.
Right.
That the ivermectin. Well, here's a fun fact to just tuck away. You know, Merck was the original inventor of ivermectin all those decades ago. It's now off patent and therefore it's in generic form, but it was Merck's drug invented back in 1975, initially as a horse drug that was subsequently used in humans. Well, Merck is coming out, people may know, with this brand new fancy oral drug for COVID called molnupiravir. Well, guess what? You know, it turns out molnupiravir isn't a new drug. It was actually invented by Merck back in 2014 to treat what? To treat equine encephalitis, a horse virus. Okay? So the mainstream media is all over Merck's new COVID drug. They aren't mentioning that was actually a horse pill, too. That was they are very, very, they pick and choose. They cherry pick what they are going to call a conspiracy and what they aren't. So I think you're right, John. Had the media and the government been more transparent or been even vaguely honest about this stuff, vaguely honest about who was really at risk, vaguely honest about the side effects, potential side effects of the vaccines, those sorts of things, what are the real numbers of COVID deaths? Not the ones that have been amped up because hospitals stand to make a lot of money, those sorts of things. So I am not, in the same way that I am not anti-vaccine, I'm not a virus denier. I've said from the very beginning, the virus is real, the statistics are not. And it's this level of deception that's gone on and on and on that leads people to start wondering things like, gosh, I wonder if Bill Gates and his family actually got vaccinated.
Right.
I wonder if Anthony Fauci got vaccinated. It does make you wonder.
Yeah, sure does. One thing that I wanted to make sure we squeezed in, because you and I had gone back and forth on this one, I wanted to make sure we got this in, because this question has been brought up by listeners of mine as well, and that's the blood bank end of things, where we've got folks donating to blood banks, unvaccinated and vaccinated both. And to my knowledge, and I think even you will agree, nobody's testing that blood to find out who it's coming from. Is there any risk of somebody that's unvaccinated having problems after getting a transfusion from somebody that's been vaccinated?
Yes, and I think it's happening. I raised the red flag on this many, many months ago, and I said I have concerns about protecting our blood supply. Letters were subsequently written by physicians with whom I work, including Dr. Peter McCullough, to the CDC and the American Red Cross, urging them to take this very, very seriously and to keep track of what blood products were being gathered from people who had been vaccinated, specifically because if people have been vaccinated, particularly any time in the past 90 or 120 days, the level of that pathogenic toxic spike protein could be very, very high in their blood. And if you give that to someone who has not been vaccinated, and particularly someone who happens, people are generally getting blood products because they're ill or injured, not because they're feeling great.
Right.
So you're already giving this to somebody who's not in top condition. Could you set off a real problem? And we are seeing people who are getting not just whole blood, but platelets and other parts of the blood that when we sort it out into different fractions, and getting profoundly ill, developing fevers. Again, the same kinds of side effects, fevers, muscle aches, chills, those sorts of things, joint swelling. And people are becoming ill after getting certain blood products, and I suspect very strongly it's because they're getting them from blood products that have high levels of spike protein. And I find it very troubling that the CDC and the FDA and the Red Cross aren't following this very, very closely. I have encouraged people in the past to, if you know that you have an elective surgical procedure coming up, say you're going for open heart surgery, and you know that it's going to be, you know, 8 or 12 weeks from now, or you have some elective surgery where you are at risk for losing blood and therefore needing blood products. So, you know, not a knee replacement, something like that, you're going to not need a blood transfusion. But anything where you might end up needing blood, and you should discuss that with your surgeon,
right,
you can bank your own blood ahead of time, assuming it's, you know, it has to be some months ahead, but you can bank your own blood at the hospital so that if you end up needing a blood transfusion, you'll get your own right back. And if you don't need it, then it can be either discarded or used by somebody else. But I think that we do have a significant threat to the security of the blood supply because of these vaccines.
Makes total sense. Somebody just asked, and I know I've asked you this before, and I think I know the answer because it's not out yet, and we don't really know all of the final say on it. But Novavax, the new vaccine that is supposedly coming to market sometime this month, have you learned any more about that since we talked about that a few weeks ago?
They have gone pretty much radio silent. Novavax is a vaccine that I felt somewhat more comfortable taking because it's not, one of these mRNA DNA vaccines. It uses the somewhat more traditional technology, meaning it takes a portion, namely, again, that spike protein, but rather than giving you the genetic code so that you, the recipient of the vaccine, start producing the spike protein, it takes the spike protein itself off of the COVID virus, kind of chops it up in a blender and injects that directly so that you aren't at risk for continuing to produce spike protein. You aren't getting that genetic blueprint to potentially continue in perpetuity to create and manufacture spike protein. Novavax is coming out of Maryland. They went radio silent. I've seen no updates. I was very, very hopeful that that vaccine was going to make it over the finish line and at least get an EUA, because I think it will be somewhat less problematic, despite the fact that it's still going to be very narrow in scope, because, again, it's targeting a singular spike protein. But at least, as I said, you aren't at the risk of having the
right
genetic code to continue to produce it.
Right. And again, I want to make sure everybody understands that, too. We've talked about that many, many times, but this, you know, today Joe's out, you know, Uncle Joe, he's out running around, you know, trying to make sure that he can push this, you know, it'll be an OSHA mandate, by the way, that comes out onto the private, private business world when that gets pushed, 100 employees or more, it's going to be an OSHA ruling, and he's out promoting that, of course, today. And again, Dr. Kelly, I really struggle with, you know, to me, I'm just a car guy. I mean, I'm not that smart. I get it. I'm not you. I'm not a doctor. I don't, you know, some of this stuff, I know what I've read, and I can decipher it that way, and I've listened to you, and I feel confident in all the things you and I have talked about. But I know enough to know that, and it makes total sense, that this vaccine that was developed some, you know, 10-plus months ago, a year ago now, was for a particular strain of COVID, which frankly has been eradicated. It's changed, it's morphed, it's not there any longer. So we're still to this day injecting a vaccine into people expecting to have a positive outcome against a variant that doesn't, you know, that vaccine wasn't even designed for. I'm flabbergasted. I guess I'm just an old, you know, old redneck that doesn't understand, but this doesn't make any sense to me.
No, I agree, and that's the problem. When I call the vaccines too narrow, or leaky, is the lay term, they are leaky because, as you rightly point out, John, the vaccines were developed for the spike protein found on the original Wuhan strain, a strain that is no longer even in existence. We are so many mutations past that now, and that is why you are seeing these vaccines fail. We were told initially, you'll remember back in December and then in January when they launched the program, we were told that all three of the vaccines, J&J, Pfizer, and Moderna, were all upwards of 95% effective. Remember, 96% effective. Then it very quickly fell to 70%, then 60%, then well down below 50%, and we are seeing a tremendous number of, quote, breakthrough cases in people who are fully vaccinated who are contracting COVID anyway. So all of a sudden, the narrative changed. Now it wasn't about being 95% effective against preventing you from getting COVID. All of a sudden, they said, that we didn't mean that. You could still get COVID, but you'll get a less severe case of COVID.
That's right. You get less COVID.
You get less severe. You know, you won't end up in the hospital.
Right.
Then, lo and behold, Yeah, except that then the study came out last week out of UC Davis, University of California, Davis, showing that, in fact, there's no significant difference, quote unquote, no significant difference between the viral loads, the amount of virus found in the noses and throats of people who are vaccinated with and end up getting COVID and people who are unvaccinated. So it turns out you get just as much of the virus as well. You might not get as sick with it, but you are just as capable of spreading it to others, mm-hmm. which begs the question, John, what is the possible scientific rationale for in any way discriminating between vaccinated people and unvaccinated people when both groups can not only get COVID, get symptomatic with it, and they can also spread it, and we now have a study proving that the amount of virus in both groups is the same. So now the narrative, as I said, has changed. You know, now it's going to make you less sick. Lo and behold, now we need boosters. It's only October, okay? We're less than 10 months into their mass vaccination program. We went from being told 95, 96% effective at stopping the virus to, oh, it just makes you have less virus, to, well, you don't actually have less virus, and now you need a booster. How about we sit back and say, you know what, guys, let's call this the epic failure that it was, and focus on, as
right.
I said at the beginning of the show,
right.
the one thing that we know that actually works,
right.
which is early treatment with all of these safe, effective, inexpensive, readily available medication.
Well done, as always, Dr. Kelly. Again, we'll plan here maybe in the next week or two. Maybe we can do a full 3-hour program, you, I, and Steve, and we'll do some things differently. So much still to talk about. As I said as we came on today, unfortunately, we're not done yet. We're going to have to keep doing this.
Unfortunately, as I said, but I will continue again to try to get this message out. Again, it's not denying the virus. It's not telling people that vaccines are bad. I'm not an anti-vaxxer in any sort, but I think people need to look at this logically and
That's
realistically,
right.
and that
That's
means
right.
starting with understanding your real risk from this, which is far less than most people
That's right.
Believe that it is, and understand
Amen.
That there are options other than vaccination should you or a family member get COVID.
All right, Dr. Kelly, I'll leave you with that. Thank you so much. As always, we appreciate it very much. Earlycovidcare.org.